while. Something you hear, something you have a hunch about. Keep him busy. Teamwork. Keep him busy? A few years ago, John was paid the lion's share of a six-figure commission that I earned on my own simply because the call was forwarded to his line when I was out of the office at a meeting. John called Kylie to let her know we'd signed the client onto the project, and she mistakenly started the paperwork, assuming it was his. He never corrected her. When I raised hell, Brad's compromise was to give me a little more money in my bonus and a lecture about team tokens. And yes, John has lost two clients this year, but he lost them because he's a backstabbing jerk who got caught gossiping nastily about one client to another client, not because he's a little distracted. When I needed a few days to help my mom during Dad's knee surgery, Brad suggested I hand over some of my clients so I wouldn't feel overwhelmed. He certainly wasn't offering to have someone assist me. Not that I'd have accepted, anyway.
I'm fine helping if that's really what he needs, I start, tone cautious. But,
Evie,
Brad sighs, pushing away from his desk to stand with his back to the wall of spotless glass behind him.
You know I don't like to bring this up, but you needed a team around you when you dropped the ball on field day.
I stiffen. Here we go. Field day was one of the biggest box office flops of recent years, and I was the agent representing and pushing for huge money for the lead actor, whose sign-on resulted in the entire project being greenlit. Think Waterworld and Geely, and you've got the right idea. It was so bad that both the film and my client won armloads of Razzies and became standard gossip rag fodder for the masses. I've actually heard someone use the phrase, it totally field-dayed, as a metaphor when a film royally underperformed. My in-house legacy, ladies and gents. The worst part is that I was crushing it before that all happened. I was the top performing agent at Alterman my last 2 years there, and I'm still in the top 20% at P&D. But with field day, my reputation and confidence took a major hit. I can't seem to shake the sense that it's the first thing everyone in the business thinks about when they meet me. Brad seems to delight in the leverage it gives him post-bomb. But like any good underling, I never remind him how many times he praised the movie's potential as,
like Bull Durham meets Avengers, sports hero gold.
As if on cue, Brad walks around his desk and props himself on the edge of it.
A bad decision like field day would have killed most agents, let alone one who hasn't proven herself yet. But did I let that happen?
He asks, pinning me with an expression that, from an outsider's perspective, would read a lot like genuine concern. I swallow back a snide retort because he's right. Brad did come to my rescue. He stuck up for me when others thought I should be let go, but he'll never let me forget about it either.
No, you had my back, I say,
not pointing out that I had proven myself by then. I'd been an agent nearly 8 years at the time.
That's right, because your failures are my failures, and your wins,
he pauses, waiting expectantly,
are your wins, I finish for him.
That's my girl.
Those three words send a blazing shiver of rage down my spine, and he rounds the desk to sink back into his chair again.
Keep me updated and go ahead and close the door on your way out.
And I'm dismissed. After my last meeting of the day, I hook up with Daryl and Amelia at Cafe Med for dinner. It has to still be at least 70 degrees where we sit on the patio, but Daryl is wrapped in a giant beige sweater and wearing sunglasses, even though the sun set nearly an hour ago. Los Angeles, man. Cafe Med is a cool little restaurant on Sunset Boulevard, which means it offers some of the best people watching around. On the sidewalk, just on the opposite side of the green railing, a woman walks by in a pair of 3-inch platforms and a silk kimono. A car pulls up at the corner with an entire desert diorama built in its rear window. We're just as likely to see a celebrity walk by as we are to see a man in a tutu pushing a baby carriage full of aluminum cans.
Heard you were in with Brad today, Amelia says to me, and then adds with a giant grin,
Bet that was fun.
He's always such a dick to you, Daryl says.
I don't know, I hedge. I think he probably has his own version of dick for everyone.
He's smart. He knows all of our buttons. We all look up as Steph dodges the hostess with a smile and jogs over to the table.
Sorry I'm late.
She hangs her purse on the back of the empty chair next to Daryl and takes a seat.
Longest client meeting ever.
We haven't even ordered yet. I hand her a menu.
But wine is on the way.
And the angels sing hallelujah, Steph mumbles, looking at the food options.
Did you guys have a good time Friday night? Daryl asks.
I did, I say honestly.
Does this mean I'm forgiven for missing it? She asks.
Steph nods emphatically, but I pop a piece of bread in my mouth and tilt my head, chewing.
Still thinking about it.
Daryl pretends to take a bullet to the chest. I open my mouth to tell both her and Amelia all about the party, when I realize that if Steph is 27 and Mike is 27 and Carter is the same age they are, then Carter is 6 years younger than I am. 6 years. As if she's read my mind, Steph puts her menu down and says,
Carter seemed to really like you.
I don't know why the age difference didn't occur to me at the party, but it seems to be a deal breaker, like a knee-jerk instinct. I've never really dated a significantly younger guy, and 27 versus 33 feels pretty significant.
We're not going to date, obviously, but if I happen to drop him a text and maybe think about him naked while doing so, does 6 years make me a cougar?
I thank the waiter when he puts my wine down in front of me, then turn to Steph.
Oy, Steph. I just realized he's your age.
Who's Carter? Amelia asks.
I don't remember hearing anything about a Carter.
He's a friend of Mike and Steph's, I tell them before sipping my wine.
He was fun. Daryl might know him, actually. He's in TV Lit at CTM.
Carter Aaron?
I've never worked with him, but here he's good.
He is good, Steph says before looking back to me.
And fun? He's hot, Evie. Carter is great looking and smart, and he's a genuinely good guy who might even be good enough for you.
I ignore this suggestion that I'm picky.
He's young, I say, a fact you neglected to mention.
He's 28.
Oof, I groan. Okay, so I'm only 5 years older than he is. I was already in school when he was born.
In kindergarten? Steph says.
Those feel like important years.
I remember being 28, and watching my guy friends then was like watching Muppets in adult male bodies trying to navigate the world.
Well, guys on the East Coast mature earlier, Steph reasons.
Amelia and I exchange a skeptical look.
28 is everyone's fake age once they turn 30, she says.
I nod.
And I'm 3 years past 30.
That just means you're in your sexual prime, Daryl sings.
Come on, live a little.
She does a little shimmy and leers in my direction, adding, a younger guy. I groan.
Honestly, Evie, Steph says, I feel like you're always looking for reasons why you can't date someone.
These words seem to reverberate in my head, even as she continues.
He had fun. You had fun. Why not call him?
I do not look for reasons not to date someone. I frown, mildly offended.
Actually, Daryl interjects. You do. You're picky and impossible.
I give Daryl a dubious glance.
Says the also single girl.
Okay, now look. Amelia holds up her hand. I get what you're saying about the age, but 5 years doesn't seem that bad. Would you give a second thought to dating a guy who is 5 years older than you are?
Stop being smart, Amelia, I mumble. She laughs.
I think you should call him.
Did you not hear the part where he's also an agent? A younger agent? Amelia winces. This reminds me. Daryl finally slips off her sunglasses. You never said what Brad wanted to talk to you about.
Oh, he wants me to help John Feynman to make sure he stays busy.
I laugh. In what universe does that make sense? John's the one who showed me around when I started at P&D. I look out to the patio area just to be sure nobody we know is around, then turn back to the girls. You know when someone's up to something, but they're questioning everything everyone else is doing? That's how I feel about Brad lately. Like when someone's having an affair and suddenly suspicious of what their partner is doing? Daryl says, nodding. Maybe, I shrug. Something's definitely up.
I know he's having a lot of earnings reports sent to his office, Amelia adds. I don't know what it means, but it's unusual enough that some of the girls in finance had to scramble.
Why does that make me a little uneasy? I ask and reach for my glass. I just don't trust Brad. See, this is exactly why you should call Carter, Steph says. Stress relief via orgasms. My friends are no help at all.
Chapter 4. Carter. MC and I are the only people who are genuinely happy that I live in LA now. My brother, obviously, could not care less, and my parents, well, even 2 years on, they're just to the left of violently opposed. It's fine for Jonah to live in Malibu because Jonah is young and chasing a dream and can do no wrong. But Carter moving to Beverly Hills? Hellfire. I call my parents Monday night to verify for them that I'm not dead in a ditch somewhere. Well, good, Dad says, but you should go see your brother more. He's lonely. Jonah? I laugh, flipping my grilled cheese in the pan. Trust me, he's not. Go see him, Mom needles from the other extension. He's just next door. Mom, he's in Malibu. It's like an hour away. Dad coughs. It's an hour from here to Brooklyn, but we make it to see your aunts every weekend. And you know what they have in Brooklyn? Sweaters on trees, Carter. I saw someone walking a goddamn peacock the last time I was there, and when I stopped for coffee. This weird little hipster place sold yarn, too. Coffee and yarn. Who the hell puts those things together? Okay, so I'll put you in the no column for Thanksgiving in L.A., I say, sliding my sandwich onto a plate. There are weirder things in L.A. than coffee and yarn. There's a heavy, meaningful pause before Mom speaks next. Jonah said you were sleeping at Michael Christopher's because you didn't have a place to live. I rub my temples. Of course you did. Jonah is a liar. You be nice, she chastises. He also said you met a girl. Taking a bite of my sandwich, I chew and swallow to give myself time to hide my irritation with my brother. She's a friend of a friend, Mom. I met her at a party. You met this woman at a party? A costume party, not a rave, I say. She's a friend of Michael and Stephanie's, so I'm assuming she's not a Hollywood madam. You're making that assumption based on Michael liking her? Mom asks. This makes me laugh. We spent a grand total of 3 hours together. It's not a thing, and I promise she's okay. She lives in Los Angeles, Carter, Mom growls. That's not okay with me. I don't understand why you couldn't find someone here. She's probably got fake boobs and that poison they put inside their foreheads. Botox, I guess. That. All right, let's take it down a notch, I say. Jonah lives in L.A., and I don't recall you ever giving him this much shit. One, watch your mouth, and two, I barely see your brother, so don't use him as a shining example. She sighs into the line. Jonah has always been a dreamer. You're my responsible one. Call him. Okay, Mom. It might take some time to get our schedules worked out, but I'll call him. That's my sweet boy. In this business, not hearing back from someone for 7 days is nothing. We're all busy, with stacks of scripts and books and audition footage to go through, phone calls to return and emails to read. Callbacks get shuffled around and ranked in order of priority. A week is nothing. I gently remind clients of this truth on a daily basis. I remind them that no news is good news. No news means they haven't heard no. But when it's your dream on the line, time takes on an entirely different meaning, and even the most patient person can lose it.
But wouldn't they know right away if they loved it? If they wanted me, they'd have called me by now, right?
Being patient is a lot easier said than done. I should know, because despite what I told Michael Christopher about not getting involved with Evie, I haven't been able to stop thinking about her. By the time Thursday afternoon rolls around and I haven't heard from her, I'm devolving into a hot mess. I think about what I said when I gave her my number Friday night. I know what we said about dating someone in this business, but I could really use more evil friends. The ball's in your court, and if you want to smack-talk our bosses or co-workers a little bit, or even just hang out and plot world domination with zero romantic expectations, you have my number. She'd laughed, ruffled my hair a little longer than was probably platonically appropriate, and then left. What I should have said was, "I really like you. Could we exchange numbers and make plans to see each other naked?" My phone rings and I jump to answer, snatching it from where it vibrates across a stack of files. "Hello?" I'm breathless.
"Hey, it's Michael Christopher. How's your day?"
Standing, I walk around the side of my desk and push the door closed with my foot.
"Pretty good. I haven't heard from her in case that's why you're calling. Again."
He pauses.
"Did you have that tie on Friday night?"
I drop back into my chair and grin.
"Which tie would that be?"
"You know which tie. The crime against humanity."
I look down at my shirt and smooth the very same tie over my chest. He knows me pretty well, apparently.
"Yes," I tell him, "this tie is my good luck charm. Bonus points for being Harry Potter appropriate."
He groans.
"You're wearing it today, aren't you? It's so bad, Carter."
"Evie wouldn't not call because of a tie."
"Look, I'm a dude, and Stephanie still has to convince me that I can't wear sweatpants when we meet friends for dinner, so I'm not casting any stones here. But even I, a slovenly wreck of a man, know that that thing should be shot and put out of its misery. I feel like I'm being visually assaulted whenever you have it on."
"But not to be dramatic." A cup of paperclip sits next to my monitor, and I reach for one, absently straightening the end.
"I'm not saying it'd be the tie's fault," he continues. "What I'm saying is that you should not be wearing something you wore while attending a sophomore year mathletes competition, Carter."
"Winning a mathletes competition," I correct, tossing the paperclip in the direction of the trash can and raising my arm in victory when it hits the rim and falls inside.
"Winning, not just attending. And for your information, I wore that same tie the day I had my scholarship interview, the day I took the SAT, and the night I got lucky with Samantha Rigby at Freshman Rush. Quality items get better with age, and that tie is one of them."
"You're the most superstitious person I know," he says. "I'm a complicated man," I tell him.
"But you're getting a little overly involved in this, I think. Did you really just call to hassle me?" "That part was a bonus. I was sitting here at work, making plans with Steph for the weekend, when I realized the weekend means it's been almost a week, and we aren't double dating yet. Then I started thinking about that tie."
I flip a pencil along my knuckles. "Michael,
you know I'm just yanking your chain. You're my favorite third wheel."
"Very funny." My phone vibrates against my ear with an incoming text. My mom has called twice since we last spoke, to ask if I've reached out to Joni yet, I'm sure, but I haven't called her back either time. It's terrible, I know this, and I know that if she's texting me right now, I have two choices, man up and call my brother, or learn how to make my own lasagna when I visit. I really don't want to do that because Mom is the best cook on the planet. I pull the phone away to check, but it's not my mom's name on the screen, it's Evie's. And she's texted me a few times already. "I need to call you back," I tell Michael and quickly end the call. "Hi, stranger. Not to be a total creeper, but do you know an agent named Elsa Tippett? She's interviewing here. We're having drinks tonight, and Steph mentioned she used to work with you."
"I did work with her at Bradford. She was nice. And hi back."
A few minutes pass, and I wonder if that's it, if that's all she had to say.
Elsa worked at Bradford for 4 years, overlapping with me for 3 of them before I moved to L.A. Some of the grocer men called her the bone collector for her propensity to sleep around the office. For the record, I never slept with Elsa, nor did I ever call her by that name. But the idea of her and Evie talking about me makes a nauseating hum take up residence in my blood. I turn back to the open script on my desk. I read. I check my phone. Nothing. Another minute ticks by. I'm halfway down the page and I have no idea what any of it said. I glance at my phone again. Should I elaborate on my connection to Elsa? Say something else? Probably yes. Should I ask her out? Think, Carter. My phone buzzes again. I emailed confirming tonight and happened to mention your name. Apparently, she has a few Carter Aaron stories. Oh, Jesus. Is intrigued. I have no Elsa stories. Others, however. Heading out. I'll report back later. An hour goes by with nothing from Evie, and I've just forgotten about it when her name pops up again on my phone. Oh boy, Elsa loves you. Oh God, this is like meeting a penthouse letter in person. She joined the firm about a year after I did. She may have known some of the men there. I am not one of those men. Ugh, I feel faintly queasy imagining what yarns she is currently spinning. 5 minutes go by, then 10. Nothing. Crap. Evil? I'm watching TV almost 2 hours later when I finally get a response. Okay, drinks are over. And yes, her stories were really oversold. Also, LOL at evil. Told you. And my phone auto-completes it. It's like it knows. I was hoping for some dirt. Apparently, you're sweet, sexy, responsible. Snore. I want to point out you called me sexy. Do you want to grab dinner next week? Yes. Yes, I do. So, of course, I immediately text Michael Christopher. All hail the lucky tie. No. Yes. No! Yes! We're having dinner. Yes! I'm going streaking. No!
Chapter 5. Evie. Are you nervous? I look up at Daryl from where I'm currently curled in half in the leg press machine. For what? My eyes go wide in fear. Are you adding more weight? She stares at me, unblinking, and then looks across the gym with a pointed sigh. Oh, because of Carter? Yes, because of Carter, she says, and follows it with this deep little growl. I can't believe you have me sucked into this soap opera. I'm basically wandering the social Sahara by myself, but I could probably recite your text messages from memory. What am I doing with my life? Sorry. I've been trying not to think about it, I say. Like, if I pretend I'm hanging out with any old agent buddy, it won't be as big a deal. I still can't believe you asked him out. She takes a drink from her water bottle. You're usually so good about sticking to your guns, but you folded. You're so going to bang him. I cover my ears. Don't get me wrong, I do want to bang him, but Carter and I have been texting back and forth over the last week, and with each exchange, I actually like him just a little more. And this is why the nerves are really starting to sink in. It's all well and good to have this flirtation when he's on the other end of a screen. It's harder to mess up when I have minutes to craft perfect, witty responses. But face to face, I'm likely to mess it up somehow. Right? As much as I try to avoid this way of thinking, it's hard not to be cynical. Like every single woman my age, I've been fixed up, from the bar scene to the book club and everything in between. Had plenty of spectacularly bad one-night stands and test-driven my fair share of dating sites. Personally, I'd rather die alone in a house full of cats in tiny matching sweaters than ever attempt any of it again. I try to ignore the pressure to be coupled up, but it's everywhere. Romance is the subject of movies and books and practically every song on the radio. There's my own biological clock, quietly yet persistently ticking away. My parents, who had me later in life, are nearing their 70s. They've long since retired from their own Hollywood careers, and when they aren't gardening or grooming their Shih Tzu, they're asking me about my dating life. But of course there's that niggling voice suggesting I not care about any of it, that maybe I should give in and buy the cats instead. The problem is I don't like them. I may be a terrible married person someday, but I know for sure I would be an even worse cat lady. Evie? Sorry, I say, exhaling as I push the weight up, extending my legs. I was just trying to figure out whether I could still be a crazy cat lady without the actual animals. Don't be weird, Daryl says. Helping me up, she reminds me. It's just a date. If you hit it off, you tell me every filthy detail tomorrow. If it sucks, you go home and we plan how we're finally going to give up on this whole dating thing and just marry each other for the tax breaks. That'll be fine. I inhale, watching as she takes my place on the bench. Anyway, how's your new assistant? Daryl lets out a loud laugh, looking up at me as she moves through her reps. Eric? Let's just say I probably do more of his work than he does. Oh, no. On top of all the other weirdness at work right now, Daryl's boss called her into his office on Monday to inform her that she's got a new assistant on her desk, Brad Kingman's nephew. Recently injured UCLA quarterback Eric Kingman is 6'3", gorgeous, and not the sharpest tool in the shed. It took him 2 days to realize that the people calling his desk and asking for Daryl did not, in fact, have the wrong number. A little smile plucks at me. It's not getting any better, then? I wouldn't say that, exactly. She sits up, shrugging as she stands from the machine. The dryer in his apartment complex overheated and all his shirts shrank, so at least the view from my office door has greatly improved. I grin as we both move to the treadmills. My assistant, Jess, is a godsend, and I would cut down anyone who tried to take her. Hot or not, I'm not trading you. Daryl shrugs. He's sweet and makes me laugh, but come staffing season, I will burn the place to the ground if he still hasn't learned how to answer a damn email. I'm sure Daryl will be fine. She runs with the upper middle of the pack, performance-wise. But she's undoubtedly beautiful and charming enough that any agency would want to keep her around. You're so good at this, Evie, she says. You're so good at handling the stress and the personalities. Blowing her cheeks out, Daryl releases a long breath. Eric is probably never going to remember everything we went over this week. Hopefully Brad will eventually figure out that this isn't the kid for the job. And I just hope Daryl isn't blamed when Eric messes something up. Because it's true that there are a million little things to remember, and when you try to make your brain roll through them like a list, they feel overwhelming. On top of that, the P&D organization itself seems to be made up of a constellation of eccentricities, of tiny, nitpicky, really irritating eccentricities. Like the way the legal department won't read emails or contracts that aren't in one of two specific fonts, or John Feinman's odd and dramatic disdain for scripts with female characters named Maria. And the fact that Brad once outright fired an assistant whose heels clicked too loudly on the marble floors near the elevators. Being an agent is about a lot of things. Balancing egos, coordinating projects, managing expectations, and above all, making money. But one thing it is never about is how something makes us feel. And as Daryl and I each retreat into our own heads and I put on my headphones, something slowly dawns on me. Perhaps one of the reasons I'm not in a relationship is that I live all of my life precisely like that, assuming that nothing is ever about how I feel. Carter and I are meeting at Evely, a rustic farm-to-table joint on Sunset in West Hollywood. It's perfectly situated between our two offices, as though we might simply leave work and stroll down the road for dinner.
And although our texts have grown increasingly flirty, I wish it had occurred to me sooner that this might really just be a casual work buddy dinner, because I have very clearly not come straight from work. Do I look too eager? Too high maintenance? I'm already concocting a credible explanation for why I might have worn a strapless black jersey dress and gold sandals to work, but when I hand my keys to the valet and look up under the vine-wrapped awning, I see Carter there, right in front of me in a dress shirt and freshly pressed trousers. He looks too crisp. There's no way he's just come from work either. In the time since I saw him last, I think I'd somehow convinced myself that he couldn't be as cute as I remembered, which would be fine because I like his personality a lot. But he is that cute. He's even better looking than I remembered, with dark, shaggy hair and a sharp jaw, and this sweetly earnest gaze behind his glasses. And when he smiles, charisma just pours out of him and onto the sidewalk. "Hey, Evil," he says, walking toward me. It doesn't feel weird to reach up and hug him. He wraps his arms all the way around me, and I shiver a little when I feel the solidness of his body against mine.
"It's so good to see you."
Don't think dirty thoughts. Don't think dirty thoughts. "You too," I say. The embrace lingers, like we're old friends seeing each other after a long separation. It isn't weird, though. It's easy, just like before. I know relationships are work. My mom reminds me of this all the time, and of the balance it takes for two people to combine their lives into one. But I've always felt like it shouldn't be work right away. Over time, yeah, I can see some effort needing to come into play when the honeymoon phase wears off and you can finally admit to yourself that it's really irritating when they leave their socks on the couch or how they slurp their milk while eating cereal. But initially, being with someone should feel like the best and most natural thing in the world. I've never really felt that chemistry before, but I definitely feel it with Carter. My blood hums just being near him, and I can't stop grinning. He smells amazing and holds me so tight, squeezing a little more just before letting go. Straightening, he gazes down at my face.
"I think I forgot how pretty you are."
"Me too." "Wait, what did I just say?" "Aw," he says, laughing.
"I like being called pretty."
Linking his fingers with mine, he turns and we check in at the hostess stand. His hand is big and secure, like a clamp around mine, and I can't stop focusing on the way it feels. So, not a buddy dinner then. Handholding might seem like a simple, innocent way to signify closeness and attraction, but my hand in Carter's feels anything but simple. They say we have more nerve endings in our fingertips than we do in our lips, and as we snake our way through the dining area and to our table, I swear I feel every millimeter of contact between us. When he lets go so we can sit, my entire body feels cold. He swallows, and I'm mesmerized by his neck and the bobbing of his Adam's apple, the way his smile slowly creeps in from the side of his mouth.
"You're quiet," he says.
"I'm really glad to be here. It's not like me to be so forthcoming, but I can't help myself. My filter seems to have malfunctioned on the walk from the front of the restaurant to my chair."
"Me too,"
he says, and then turns his attention to the incoming waiter who tells us the specials and takes our drink orders.
"I'll have a Red Bull and vodka,"
Carter says, and I snort. When the waiter makes a slight face but starts to write it down, Carter stops him.
"Not really. Sorry. I'm kidding. Inside joke. Bad joke. I'll have whatever IPA you have on tap."
The waiter is unamused.
"Stone or Lagunitas?"
"Lagunitas." Carter's tongue peeks out, touching his lower lip. I can't stop looking at him. The waiter turns to me. "I'll have a glass of the Preston Barbera." When the waiter leaves, Carter leans an elbow on the table.
"You give good shoulder."
"I... what?" He nods to my dress.
"Your dress. Your shoulders."
Clearing his throat, he adds quietly,
"You just
look amazing. I whisper, thanks, and take a long drink of ice water to cool down the boiling just beneath the surface of my skin. So, what's the latest in Carterland? He grins at my subject change.
Work, dodging calls from my parents, texting a cute agent down the road, you know.
I blush, deflecting. You're dodging your parents?
They want me to make more of an effort with my brother, but really it's just their continued disapproval that I moved here in the first place.
Oh, no. He waves this off.
Mom is positive I'm going to end up homeless and buying crystal meth from a guy living in a box on Skid Row. I tried to tell her my apartment has a doorman and I don't even know where Skid Row is, but she remains unconvinced.
The waiter brings our drinks, bread, and a tiny notepad ready for our orders. My parents are both in Burbank now, I tell Carter once the waiter leaves again. So I see them a few times a month, but I can imagine how much my mom would worry if I lived across the country.
Yes, but my brother moved here when he was 18 and there was little to no meltdown.
I tear off a piece of bread. I don't think I knew that.
Jonah, he explains over his glass, took his camera and his clothes and left. He went to a party one of his first weekends in town and ended up taking some photos that were featured in Rolling Stone.
You're kidding me.
Nope. From there it was L, then People. For some reason my parents think lightning only strikes once and I am destined to flop.
I want to remind him that all parents worry their children will struggle, and that if there was ever a place where that happened a lot, it's Hollywood. But my mind snags on something he's said.
Wait, is your brother Jonah Aaron?
He is.
His eyes go wide, his hand frozen where it was lifting a piece of bread to his lips.
Please tell me you haven't slept with him.
I cough out a laugh.
That would be a no. But for some reason, I think my friend Amelia has.
I take a sip of wine, thinking. I think she met him at a Vanity Fair party or something. Carter gives me a rueful half-smile.
Maybe I should find her and apologize on behalf of my family.
When I laugh again, he seems to realize what he's said.
I mean, no.
He corrects, brows furrowed.
Sex with the Aaron men is prime. Best sex of your life. I should clarify that. Let's move on. Work is good?
A laugh trips out of me and I press my napkin to my lips.
It's really good. I'm putting together a package right now and it could be pretty big.
There's something about Carter that diffuses my usual instinct to keep everything close, and it's a struggle to not spill every detail. But if he notices how I've reeled myself in, he's polite enough not to let on and instead knocks on the top of the table.
Superstitious?
I ask, but he's kept from answering as the waiter arrives with our entrees. Carter washes his first bite of steak down with his beer and then sets the glass back on the table.
In answer to your question, I would never say that I'm superstitious because that would be bad luck, but it has been suggested to be one of my less charming traits.
I grin up at him, spearing a piece of broccoli.
Mostly, I consider them quirks, he says. It's possible I have a lucky tie. The old knock-on-wood one is a favorite. I throw spilled salt over my left shoulder. I've been known to frequent wishing wells, and I have to let the phone ring twice before answering.
Those are so adorably minor, I say.
You have some better ones?
I'm sure my friends would tell you I am quirks galore. Carter leans back in his chair and motions for me to proceed. I've already illustrated my knack for recalling random movie details.
I don't know if that counts. Maybe more of an asset considering your line of work. I'm going to need a bit quirkier from you, Evil.
I smile.
I can't eat at buffets. A snag when so many catered events are the serve-yourself variety.
It's like I see that innocent serving spoon and all I can think about is how many unwashed hands have touched it. I always watch the 24-hour Christmas Story marathon, and I'm an obsessive hand creamer. He stops with his fork halfway to his mouth.
That can't possibly mean what just popped into my head.
I move to gently kick him, but he traps my foot, keeping it there between his shoes. It means that when I'm on a call or sitting at my desk thinking about something, I tend to reach for my lotion, sort of instinctively. The longer the call, the more lotion I'll use, and by the end I can barely grip my phone.
Okay, that's pretty great.
Carter rubs his palms together, thinking.
I'm gonna give you another one of mine so you don't feel all insecure about your germ phobia or cream-filled hands.
I can barely inhale before I've had coffee. I know people say that all the time, but in my case, I almost feel like it's a medical condition. I've brushed my teeth with shaving cream on more than one occasion, and once relieved myself in my mom's favorite potted plant.
I'm not sure you should share that last part, I whisper.
Carter wipes his mouth and sets his napkin on the table in front of him.
You've got a very mischievous smile there, Evil.
I point to my chest.
Me? You should see yours.
He leans forward.
It's because I like being around you. It's like the same buzzy feeling I get when one of my clients posts a grammatically correct tweet.
This makes me laugh because I can absolutely relate.
That's pretty buzzy.
He pulls his lower lip into his mouth and sucks it, watching me. I don't remember Carter being this overwhelmingly sexual when we first met. Maybe it was because I wasn't showing shoulder or because we were both dressed as preteens, but it's definitely overwhelming right now. Carter sips his beer, looking out through the foliage of the indoor-outdoor space to the sidewalk. It's a busy neighborhood any time, but it's cooled down a bit tonight, and the streets seem full of people out walking, headed somewhere, headed nowhere.
It's so warm here in the fall, he says, tilting his glass up to his mouth again.
I watch him swallow, feeling this tight, creeping anxiety because, damn it, I like him.
It surprises me every time.
I might really like him. Our summer always comes late, I say.
June and July are pretty nice. The summer really hits in August through October.
He turns back to me and smiles.
I wonder if I'll ever get used to it.
Was it a hard decision to leave New York? He shakes his head.
Not really. I'd thought about it for a few years, but always hesitated because it sort of felt like Jonah's territory.
I could see that, I guess.
But as my career progressed, L.A. became an obvious option.
He spins his spoon on the table, absently staring down at it.
There's only so much for talent agents in New York. Theater is huge, obviously, but I don't know.
Taking a deep breath, he seems to grow more contemplative until he exhales and turns his face up to me, smiling again.
I needed to do something different. I like TV lit, but would like to be more film-based. Baby steps.
The degree to which he's genuine throws me again and again. Everything about him seems so upfront and frank, but there's a complexity, too. No wonder he's good at this job.
Have you ever considered leaving California? He asks.
Not really, I admit, scrunching my nose. I'm too much of a movie fanatic to give it up.
Where did you grow up?
I hook my thumb behind me as if he can see it from here.
Not L.A. proper, in San Dimas.
Bill and Ted's,
he sings.
That's what everyone says, I tell him, laughing. And yes, it's a pretty small town.
I was such a nerd in high school. He gives a skeptical snort.
Honestly, I assure him.
I was. You couldn't have been as nerdy as I was. The founder of my school's Magic the Gathering Club.
Nodding, I tell him, I was president and sole member of the anime club at my school before anyone else liked it.
Anime is cool.
It wasn't then, trust me.
Carter leans in, clearly ready to bring out his big guns.
I didn't get a date in high school until senior year because I liked show tunes and the girls assumed I was gay. No guys asked me out either because they assumed I was stuck up, not straight.
My first concert was Hanson.
I pause, watching him.
My worst fear is someone posting a video of me in isolation rocking my face off the entire time.
Are you trying to scare me away?
He pulls out his phone and spends about 30 seconds scrolling until he turns it for me to see. Look at this mess. Carter is probably 14 in the picture. His nose is too big for his face. His hair looks like it was cut by a distracted parent. He's laughing and his mouth seems completely filled with metal. I can top that. I pull out my phone and open it to my mother's Facebook page, easily finding her Throwback Thursday post to my 10th grade school picture. This was before my LASIK, so I have glasses thicker than an ashtray, and I'm wearing a tie because I was trying to pull off some ill-advised skater chic. Carter's eyes narrow and he leans in to look closer.
What are you talking about, Evie? You're pretty here.
Wow, he is blind. Carter.
What?
He looks up and something, no, everything in me melts. When he blinks, the soft expression doesn't dissolve. It stays there, stronger now as he lets his gaze move across my face and to my mouth.
What?
He says again, smiling now.
You know I'm hoping to kiss you later, no matter how many dorky pictures you show me.
My heart takes off, a beating drum in the wild jungle beneath my ribs.
I'm older than you, I blurt.
He just shrugs, like this was a completely normal thing to say.
So? We're in the same business.
I watch him process this for a breath, and he chews on his lip before saying,
Maybe it's not ideal, but it's not worth staying away from you because of it.
My heart seems intent on climbing up into my throat.
I'm notoriously married to my job. That's super convenient, because so am I. It'll be like we're cheating on our jobs with each other.
He says this as if he's just discovered some brilliant loophole. I'm aware of how I'm perched on my chair and of the woman at the table next to us watching us without any subtlety. I'm aware of the car alarm going off somewhere down the street and the waiter clearing plates at the table behind me. I have the sense that Carter can see me reacting to all of these things but isn't fazed by it in the slightest.
I'm pretty bad at this, I admit. But I have a great romance backup plan that includes a pack of small animals in sweaters with me as their leader.
His smile is warm and slow, and when it reaches his eyes, something inside my chest turns over in defeat.
That could be cool, too.
In the silence that follows, it seems like an enormous hole opens up in front of me, and I decide to jump straight in.
Do you want to come back to my place after this?
This surprises him, and his eyes widen slightly behind his glasses.
Yes.
Because it's Southern California, and everyone drives everywhere, alone in their own car, Carter follows me back to my place. My building is in Beverly Grove, just southeast of Santa Monica Boulevard. The area has sprawling houses and wide lawns interspersed with larger, remodeled Art Deco apartment buildings. L.A. is like that. Suburb and city all swirled together. I meet him at the front entrance and try to smile like this is no big deal, but it's an enormous deal. The last guy I had at my place was my dad. Before that, it was Mike when he came for dinner with Steph. Before that, I can hardly remember. Probably the cable guy. I can tell we're both unsure what to say, and the energy between us buzzes. He has this sexual charisma that I'm not convinced I can handle. I can't stop replaying our hug at the front of the restaurant and how he felt against me. All long bones and firm muscle. I'm sort of relieved that Carter isn't one for small talk in situations like this. Are we going to have sex?
I feel like sex is imminent, but would rather shove a hot poker in my ear than trust my instincts on this right now.
He could ask me about the weather, or about traffic, or earthquake statistics, or any number of the obvious California topics, but he just follows me into my place and pauses in the living room, looking around. It's a nice place, and I'm proud of it, even though I'm hardly ever home for more than sleeping. The building is modern, and my apartment is an open floor plan that includes a large main room with living room, kitchen, and small nook by the window where I have a table. There's a vase of flowers on top, and everything smells subtly of the peppermint candle near the stove. I can even see Carter's eyes widen at the enormous flat screen I inherited from my dad when he upgraded to the obscene flat screen. The guy across the alley is a juggler, I say, motioning to the window. Apparently it's a clothing optional hobby. I'm not gonna lie, it's pretty great. I was already going to say this place was cool, but that might earn an upgrade to amazing, he says. I can promise you that none of the apartments I looked at came with a naked juggler. It's usually in the morning. The implication of my words, sleepover, lingers between us as he steps closer, clearly moving past the exploring Evie's apartment phase of the evening into just exploring Evie. Carter is only a step away from me and his hand comes out, curling around my hip. A few beats of silence pass. Are you thirsty? I ask, jittery. Traffic on the street blares past and a dog barks obnoxiously in the building next door. Carter shakes his head.
No, I'm okay.
Okay. I chew my lip. Hungry? Or need to use the restroom? He laughs.
No.
My hand is shaking when I take his and lead him down the hall.
Evie?
He hooks his thumb back over his shoulder.
We can stay out here.
I shake my head, and he follows me wordlessly down the hall into my bedroom. He pulls up short, just inside the door.
It's just that I don't think we should...
He glances to the bed and then back to me.
Yet.
That's okay. I agree in a nervous whisper. I just want to be in here. My parents gave me all the furniture in the living room, and I don't want to be thinking about this the next time they're over here sitting on their old couch. His eyes crinkle behind his glasses when he smiles at this.
You're a trip.
He says it like it's a good thing. Like it's a great thing. In my room, we stare at each other for a few seconds. I keep waiting for the weirdness to descend, but it doesn't. Carter lifts his hands, cups my face, and smiles at me. Oh, God, my heart is going to jackhammer its way out of my chest. I am definitely not planning a wedding to Daryl tonight.
You okay?
He whispers, just an inch away from kissing me.
Yeah.
He leans in, putting his lips against mine. I honestly can't describe the way it feels to kiss him. I marvel at the smooth firmness of his lips and the contrasting sharp stubble on his upper lip and chin. I imagine it scraping the skin of my neck and down, down. I marvel at his hands, holding me right up against him, sliding around my back. A current runs through me when his tongue touches mine. It's even stronger when he makes a quiet little groan and slides one hand down over my ass. I feel like a teenager the way I'm unable to get enough of his mouth and just come at it from every angle, needing every kind of kiss he has, bigger and smaller, deeper, and just these tiny little kisses like raindrops. I feel like I've been kissing him forever, and also like I've never really been kissed before tonight. He's taller than me, and I'm on my toes, stretching to get closer, like I need him inside me however I can. Gently, his hands slide to my hips, guiding me back toward the bed and down. He follows, helping us both toward the pillows, and I haven't felt this hunger in so long. The consuming kind of want, where kissing like this is nearly overstimulating, but my body keeps pushing for more and more. Carter is over me, and we're moving together, and I feel him, hard between my legs. His bare hand cups the back of my bare leg, and I bring my knee toward my chest, opening myself, wanting him closer. He lets out this small grunt before telling me we seem to be really good at this. The way he moves, rocking just right against me. I know I'm already close because, God, it's been so long and it's so, so good. We are good at this.
And if almost sex with our clothes on has me on the edge already, how would I survive naked Carter? Carter that has access to every part of me. I can feel that tension and warmth just there, but he pulls away. I start to tell him to come back, reaching for his hips, but his hand is there, warm and steady, up my leg, down inside my underwear, and he groans into a kiss when he feels me, slippery under his fingers. I feel frantic, like I've been twisted in a ringer, and I have to clench my teeth so I don't cry out. Instead, a shaky whine escapes, and it makes his breath catch. He pulls back to look at my face. "You're wound so tight," he whispers before bending to kiss my neck. "How do I make you unravel?" His hand is moving, and his mouth slides from my neck to my jaw, and even when I arch away, eyes closed, I feel him follow me, his lips chasing my skin, telling me to come here. Kiss him, tell him what I like. When I open my eyes, he's still watching me. He smiles, leaning in to kiss me again. "This okay?" he says, eyes clear and earnest. I nod. Relief is like a drug, warm, rushing through my limbs. We're doing this. I work at his belt, clumsily, no longer concerned with when and where we have sex, and his laugh is a tiny warm burst of air against my lips. I get that he's not laughing at me. He's laughing at this, at the frantic, fumbling groping. I smooth my palm down his stomach and gasp at the feel of him, the thrill of making him hard like this, the rush from the power of it. He moves into my touch, and I slide my leg over his hip, and like this we shift together, letting our hips do the work, letting our mouths move in this easy, hungry tandem. I've forgotten the fevered powerlessness of letting someone else touch me, the desperate hope that they'll get me there. But very soon I realize that he will. And he does. His hand steady against me. I try to keep my eyes open as it builds, but he watches me with such a singular intensity that I close them so it's just the sensation of his fingers on my clit and his cock in my hand, and I dissolve. His sounds propel me on. Quiet grunts, and he's moving faster, so hard against my palm, fucking, and then he comes with a helpless groan, living and vital in my grip. His relief so warm against my skin. He laughs again, stilling my hips with the hand he's used to touch me. It's wet, and the intimacy of that, the knowledge that he knows how I feel and just made me come, makes me ache all over again. We fall quiet in the darkness. Carter's mouth finds mine, and he kisses me with that telling, satisfied laziness.
"Still okay?"
he asks in a deep, scratchy rumble.
"Yeah.
You?"
"I'm great, are you kidding? I didn't have to do that by myself later tonight."
I start to laugh, but he immediately consumes the sound of it, his mouth coming back over mine.
"I think I made a mess on your comforter, though."
I pull away, feeling down between us.
My bed is like, "What is this substance?"
He laughs hoarsely into my neck, and just when I start to worry whether I've just sounded too single, he says,
"Yeah, me too."
"You're insanely hot. I don't believe you haven't been with someone recently."
"And you're gorgeous. The lack of opportunity isn't why we're single."
I nod, looking up at his face.
"It's been suggested that I'm picky. And maybe a little work-obsessed."
He laughs again at this, bending to kiss me.
"I just think we both need something else to look forward to every day."
Chapter 6. Carter. Saturday night, Michael Christopher and I have been put in charge of food prep, which is just code for me doing the cooking and Michael keeping Morgan from pulling out every pot and pan in the house. He's at the table, and she is happily pelting him in the face with Cheerios.
Steph comes in, carrying with her the scent of freshly cut grass, and a rush of cool air slips in through the door behind her. Although it's the weekend, she'd gone into work when a huge up-and-coming actor landed himself in jail. It reminded me of what Evie said about being married to her job, and I know this kind of thing. The late nights and missed dinners is exactly what she meant. She looks at us, impressed with the dinner spread, and sits down. Wow. She doesn't even have to ask to know how it all materialized in front of her. Well done, Carter. It's nice to cook in an actual kitchen with actual cookware. Steph gives me a sympathetic smile while MC glares at me, envious. So, how have you been? Steph asks. Busy. Emil Shepherd is moving to my list and it's creating a little paperwork headache in-house. She winces. Oh God, is Blake losing his mind? You'd think so, but honestly, he barely blinked. I shrug and spear a piece of chicken from my plate. Maybe he's getting laid. Old Blake would have ripped off my legs and beaten me with them. There's something in the air. It has been such a shit show of a day. Steph cringes, glancing to Morgan. Oops! Earmuffs, baby! We all wait in tense silence, wondering whether Morgan is going to gleefully sing out the words, shit show! It happened before with dammit, motherfucker, and asshole. This time, she refrains. Relieved, Steph turns back to me. How was your date? MC perks up. I take a bite of my dinner and chew while I think, hoping my face doesn't betray me. My heart jolts noticeably when I think about last night. I haven't had this kind of physical reaction to a woman in years. It was great, I say. I glance at Morgan mid-sentence. Freaking great. Great, Steph agrees slowly with a smile to match her tone. She watches me like I'm going to elaborate, but in reality, what more can I say? I want things with Evie to go somewhere, and I really think that they can. That's why I told her I didn't want us to have sex yet, even though I really, really wanted to. She was similarly bare bones on details. Stephanie stabs her chicken with a fork. You're both brats. Am I supposed to tell you about our first kiss during study hall? She shoots up, eyes glimmering. You guys kissed. All right, crazy. Michael puts his hand on her forearm. Let's not scare the nice boy away. They'll tell us what they want us to know when they want us to know it. I mean, at the very least, they'll remember who brought them together when they're deciding who's best man at their wedding. Is this what happens when you're married with kids? I grin at each of them in turn. You have nothing to do but pair everyone off? On cue, they both lean in, voices erupting in unison. We haven't slowed down. We have a crazy social life. Morgan, who clearly finds the synchronized outburst cause for celebration, blows bubbles in her milk until it's foaming over the sides. No, no, I say, full of youth, of course, but you're also sort of settled. Settled? Steph scoffs. Please, we, she points between the two of them, are crazy. We can party with the best of them. Trust me. You still hit the club sometimes? I give them an encouraging nod. Of course we do. She points to her arm, and after a bewildered moment, I realize she's wordlessly reminding me that she has a flower tattoo, and that people with tattoos are obviously likely to be found at clubs. There's this place called Foxtail that's so cool. You should definitely take Evie there. Or he could take her to Orchid, right, Steph? That place is pretty good, she agrees. Craft cocktails, right? Or there's that other one. She snaps her fingers, as if this will help her recall the name. Areola. Michael finishes for her. Now that place, he whistles, that place is insane, he says, dragging the word out into about four syllables. Steph is nodding. I have to ask, there's a club called Areola? Oh, yeah, it's like the hippest place in L.A., she says. Oh, she deflates a little. No, babe, I think it's not Areola. That's a nipple, right? I think it's Areola. I mean, that's a pretty big difference, I note with a serious nod. Areola, Michael agrees, laughing as he avoids my gaze. Have you two gone? Us. Come on, MC says with a tight cough, like, of course we have. We wanted to, but they don't even open until, like, 9, I think, babe, is it 9?